Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when I am on the air.
This is Fran Lewis, and I'm waiting for the author of The Chosen One who has not called in. So I'm going to talk about some other stuff first, and hopefully he will call in. And if he doesn't, then I guess that maybe he forgot. I don't know. I emailed him 7 times. On Monday, I have Vincent Zandri and Lee Matthew Goldberg, and we're going to talk about thriller writers talking about thriller writers. On February 3rd, I am honored to have Dr. Jeffrey Jacobson talking about hand surgeries and different things that people need to understand before undergoing hand surgeries, like carpal tunnel syndrome. On the 4th, I have Brian Friedman and Thief River Falls. And on the 19th, we have the author of The Neighborhood. And on the 24th, we have R.G. Belsky, Silent Victim. On the 27th, we have 3 authors of The Montague Murders. So that is what's coming up so far. My new book is going to be called 1951 Southern Boulevard. And I'm hoping that the publisher that I sent it to will take it. I'm not sure. We'll find out. And Silent Voices, unfortunately, is not going to be on Amazon anymore. The publisher is going out of business. So we're waiting. I'm still waiting for the author to call in. He's not here yet. And I did email him like 7 times, and I have no idea what happened to Walter Craig. So I'm going to try one more time, and if he's not here in 5 minutes, I am going to cancel the show. I don't know if he's aware or not. Please call in now on the air. And I'm giving you the number is 347-884-9045. And he's not here. So I'm going to give it another 5 minutes, and that's what I'm going to do. He's not here. And what can I say? Give it another 5 minutes. I emailed him 7 times, gave him the number, called his publicist, and I have no idea. And I know that it was in his schedule. Okay, for those of you that want to know what I'm reading, I am reading Within Plain Sight by Bruce Coffin. It's a John Byron mystery. For those of you else who want to know what I'm reading, You Are Not Alone, which is a cycle, really fantastic book, and there are a few others that I have on my list. I just got a book by Gabriel Vajon, and I've got a few more by Robert Degoni, supposed to be sending his Tracy Crestwhite book. And I'm going to tell you something about this book, and we'll see what happens. If he doesn't call in 2 minutes, I'm going to end the episode, and that's it, because I cannot wait here forever. This is a book about a person that became a jihadist. And the title of the book is called The Chosen One. 2 months ago, a new leader arose in the Islamic world, the Mahdi of the Chosen One. He has rallied fundamentalist fighters across the Middle East and who have driven deep into Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Standing against them are allied forces made up primarily of the American military. Marine Lieutenant Sam Erickson is the thick of fighting. He and his company have battled their way from a landing on a Mediterranean shore to the outskirts of Cairo. Sacrifices on both sides as a slew Islamic leader forges ahead, hoping to create a new Islamic world. And I was really looking forward to talking about this book, but obviously the author forgot. So I'm going to give it another minute or two, and then I'm going to tell him, I'm going to email him, and I'm going to cancel the show. Canceling the show. Jeff, I'm going to end it, okay? I don't know. It's like 5 minutes, and he hasn't even. I emailed him 7 times already. I mean, and this is going on. Let me see if anybody answered me. And I don't get this. This is rude. Okay. She's sending him the right note. I emailed him 7 times. I emailed him. The right one. She said she just did the right one. Yes, she got my message, and she said he had the wrong number, but I know I sent the right one. And I'm going to wait because she said she's calling him back to tell him to call into the right number. We'll see what happens. Okay. Meanwhile, let's take a list of all the wonderful books that I have read. Stuart Wood's The Hit List is coming out in March, and Crazy Ass Stories for Crazy Ass People by Andy Ross. You want to read it. The stories are absolutely crazy. Iris Johansson, Hindsight, and here we go. There he is. Hi, how are you? What happened?
My publicist got the number written down wrong. I've been calling like crazy and being told that number doesn't work. So I finally just talked to them, and they gave me the right number. So I apologize for that.
That's okay. I emailed you a couple of times, and I'm going like, oh, my God. I have been looking forward to talking about this book forever. And let me tell you, there are an awful lot of people that have their hands out to take this one away from me the minute I'm done.
Oh, okay.
It's positive, let me tell you. Yeah, a lot of people they've heard about the book and they want to read it.
Well, you know, don't give them your copy. Have them buy their own. That would make me happy.
That's exactly right, because they're not getting this one because this is too good. And, okay, how did you come up with this plot? Because I'm saying there had to be a reason why you wrote this, and I'm going like, I got the chills reading it. Every Islamic leader has a background and a past and an ideology. How did you create the Mahdi? How did you create this kid? And I could tell, you know, like listening to both sides, I understand his point of view, believe it or not. So why did they want him?
Yeah.
I told you, I did. I understood it. But, I mean, why did they want him to become this? What was their rationale? I mean, look what happened to him.
Well, actually, I'm kind of I wouldn't call myself a history buff, but I like to pride myself on paying attention to history. And mm-hmm. so what I like to do in my novels is take past historical events and move them to now with kind of a what-if-it-happened-now kind of scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And so along with the interest in history, I had grown up in a very fundamentalist Christian family, and they lived and breathed every day the end of time, the revelations, the rapture. That's all I ever heard, daily. And so I thought, you know, there are lots of end of times scenarios. Just about every religion has them. All the way back to the Mayans and beyond, I'm sure. So I thought, why don't I look at historical events about end-of-time scenarios and see which one makes the most sense to write about? And Islam was the one that jumped out.
No, I can understand that.
The reason for that is there's actually for your older listeners who've watched some old movies, there's a Charlton Heston movie called Khartoum, and it's based on a historical event that in 1885, I want to say, a Mahdi arose in Sudan. There have been a number of Mahdis through history. I mean, Omar Gaddafi tried to claim he was the Mahdi. So in 1885, one arose, created a very fanatical army, and they attacked and slaughtered the British there in Libya. In Sudan. So I took that, and I took how this guy had done this and how his followers had acted, And I simply moved them to now. And so I decided, like I said, that was the one with the most modern history and the most, what I thought was the most fascinating end of time scenario. What the scenario, I'm going to give a very, very basic definition of what the Mahdi scenario is about, mm-hmm. what the Islamic end of days prophecy is about. The Mahdi, it's not in the Quran. It's a separate prophecy, mm-hmm. kind of like the rapture is to some Christians. That's not in the Bible. But it's something they believe. The Mahdi is supposed to arise. He's supposed to conquer the world for Islam. Mm-hmm. And then lead it through its final days, and those days are supposed to be wonderful days. And it's I've seen four different timelines for how long he will rule after he conquers the world, and it's anywhere from 5 to 19 years. There's an involvement of Jesus in it. They bring Jesus into it. It's a very kind of fascinating end of day scenario. So I was not trying to be judgmental of Islam at all. That's not the intent. The intent was simply to show. I loved in the book to be able to take multiple characters, including Muhammad Murad, the Mahdi, and show how they became who they became. I did that with my Marine lieutenant. I did that with his love interest, this very famous reporter. And that's what I was really going for. And I'm hoping that anybody of the Islamic faith won't be offended by this book. It's not the intent. It's simply to present it. And I wanted to present Murad as a three-dimensional character. I wanted him to be one of the most interesting antagonists you'd ever seen. And it sounds like I did that for you, Fran. I don't know.
You know, I didn't know what the book was about, to be honest. And Jennifer sent it to me because basically people just send me books and don't tell me I'm getting them. So when this arrived, I said, I sat down to read it, and I'm going like, what am I reading? I couldn't put it down. I literally couldn't put it down because with what's going on in the news, I think this is a great way for people to understand the mindset of somebody that becomes a Mahdi. I mean, seriously, it's like, oh, my God, this is so – I'm an educator by far. And I work with kids that are natural learners and children that have learning disabilities in reading and writing. So what he strikes me as is just when he was younger, is that he was a natural learner. And his teachers and his fathers realized that he was above everybody. So he was extremely, extremely proud. Extremely, extremely smart. So he had to do what they told him to do. And yet his mother was different. Why did his father decide that this was his future that he wanted? He had no choice. So after a while, I realized that he had no choice. He had
exactly.
to be this person. See,
yeah,
I got it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. He. If you'd have left him alone, he'd have stayed in his little desert oasis there in Algeria and never done any more than lived out his life and been perfectly happy with that, more than likely. But others stepped in. It wasn't just his father or his uncle. There were all the clerics and so they convinced him he was this person, and because he was a very intelligent individual and had very, very fervent beliefs in his religion, he refused to accept it at first, but he finally did. And so it led him down this path to where he ended up, first of all, conquering Algeria and Libya and Sudan and Tunisia and creating this federation, and then deciding it was time for them to conquer the world, for him to fulfill the prophecy. And so he decides the first thing he's got to do really is to kind of unify Islam. And to do that, his first step is to attack his neighbor, Egypt. And at least in the book, the Americans have a mutual defense pact with Egypt. And as the book opens, Cairo is a hair's breadth away from falling, and the Americans are desperately trying to stop that. So that's where we open the book, and then we go back, and I kind of do a backstory on Muhammad Murad and how he becomes who he becomes, and we move on. As you might have noticed in the book, I like to tell my stories by talking about what are essentially ordinary people caught in extraordinary mm-hmm. circumstances. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a big fan of superheroes. You know, I don't really believe the superhero with his who's got a paperclip and a sharp stick is able to kill 20 incredible killers with automatic weapons. It just doesn't happen that way. And so I like to write about I think the most interesting thing about writing military novels is not all this techno-thriller stuff. I don't even like that stuff. It's, mm-hmm. it's the person behind the weapon that's the interesting part of the scenario. And so what I did in this book is I actually told four different stories that were on all ongoing mm-hmm. at once. And mm-hmm. I did a similar thing in my first novel. I actually had five different stories going on in that one. And through that method, you're able to see the entire war, more or less, unfolding. And so it, people seem to be responding to it really well. I know I had a lot of people with the first novel who said the exact same things you did. The first one's called The Final Ace. And I'm sorry, it's called The Red Line. My original title is The Final Ace. The publisher changed it, The Red Line. And I had a ton of people that would write me and say, wow, this may be the best book I've ever read. I couldn't put it down. And I'm getting those emails are starting to show up, too. The Chosen One hasn't been out there but, 2 months. And those are definitely popping up. So that's very pleasing to a writer to be told that the reader couldn't put it down. So I'm very pleased you had that reaction.
I haven't had that reaction in a while. I have read, my husband counted on my computer, over 20,000 book reviews in 10 years. Seriously. That many. I'm serious. And I read like 10 books a week because I'm a speed reader, which is even more difficult sometimes. And my mother termed, I've been reading since I'm 3, so, and she made me read like 6 books a week. So, yeah, I haven't had a book in a while that I said, oh, God, I can't wait to put this down. And this was really, I told a lot of people about it, and a lot of people know about it. So you're going to have a lot more. My 5 stars are out there. Trust me, they're there. My 5 stars were out there the day the book came out. So let's go to the other half of it. The
okay.
other character that I really liked was Sam Erickson.
Uh-huh.
I really liked him. I wasn't sure about the American Reporter, to be honest. I wasn't crazy about her. But what research did you use in order to create the battle scenes that were to come? I felt like it was, and I haven't felt this way in a while, I felt like I was right in there with them, the way you described it.
I was fighting with them. Fran, you ought to read The Red Line if you think you're right in there. That one people told me 1,000 times. I had to put this down because I thought I was standing in the snow with the American soldiers
exactly.
as the Russian tanks approached. I literally had to put the book down because I was terrified all of a sudden. I thought I was there. And so I'm glad you got that reaction with The Chosen One.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the Army for a number of years. I worked for them also as a civilian employee for a while. So in all, I spent about 20 years with the military. And during that time, I didn't know tons about the Marines. I'd done one joint service assignment where we had Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines all in one fairly small unit. So I knew something about them. My old running partner at lunchtime was a Marine major, so I knew something about them. And I just thought if you were in a desperate situation, what's the quickest unit you can get there? And it would probably be 82nd Airborne, which I bring in pretty quickly, and certainly the Marines, because they're both light fighting forces that are fairly mobile. And trying to bring in a bunch of tanks takes a while, but you can put a soldier or a Marine on an airplane and zip them somewhere pretty quickly. And what happened here, actually, I have a good friend, and I acknowledge him in the book, up in the acknowledgments, who's a former Marine helicopter pilot. So he served as my technical advisor on all the Marine stuff. And I certainly didn't get it all right the first time, but luckily he was able to steer me right on a few things that I had a bit wrong. But hopefully, I'm not going to pretend, like I said, I don't like to write technical books. I mean, military thrillers have gotten kind of a bad rap, and few people read them because they've become technical manuals, Army technical manuals, which I always found very boring when I was in the Army. I try to write about the people. So sometimes I will actually let the technical side slip a little bit on purpose because it doesn't fit the story. I do that more in The Red Line than I do in The Chosen One. But my friend Chuck up in Dallas was willing to help me with this one, and so we kind of made it work out. I think the Marine units have the right number of Marines in each squad and the right ranks and things like that and the right weapons. So it's close enough here, I think. So that's kind of how I did the Marine stuff, is I had a technical advisor who helped me. But I am kind of familiar with all four services. It's been a while since I was in. After I left my work with the Army, I then went to law school at the University of Texas and then did that for about 20 years. And while I was doing that, I started writing the novels. I wrote the Red Line first and then The Chosen One. And how exactly I came up with the storyline for The Chosen One, and like I said, I'm not very clear. They just seem to show up. And they kind of develop as you go.
It could have been about anybody that became a Mahdi. Could have been anybody that you're reading about in the news, too. It's frightening. And I said that, and then I told it to several people in a whole bunch of offices. And I went to the bakery this morning, and I said it to somebody. So I'm interviewing the author. She said, "Oh, my God, I heard about that one. I got to get it." I go, "Well, go right ahead. Amazon will send you one. Don't worry."
The author approves of you getting it.
It's not like you're unknown. Yeah, you're kind of popular out there. And by the time I get done, you're going to be really popular.
Oh.
That's what they tell me.
Oh, well, I hope so. But I don't really consider myself popular or certainly no one significant. I just sit at my little desk and write my little novels and go out and do a few book signings and attend a few conferences. I know you're up in the New York area, right?
Well, I'll tell you something. I have my own magazine. I wrote a whole bunch of books, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The funny part about it is that the library up here and the books are up here because I'm independently published. As a matter of fact, my last book was independently published, and the publisher's going out of business, so I have to have it republished somewhere else. And the one that I had published by a traditional publisher didn't have returnability, so they won't help me. They have book signings in everywhere, but they won't have them up here where I am in Westchester. So I just do my own promoting and whatever. So there's a character in the book that I really like.
Uh-huh.
Mitchell. Mitchell.
Oh, yeah.
And I felt bad
that
for him. You had a whole bunch of characters. But I also noticed something about the upper echelon of Sam's, the people that were above him. And they didn't seem to really care that anybody was dead, alive, or whatever. They just wanted this to happen. I mean, there was no rest for the weary. So tell us about Mitchell, and his wife's father had a lot of things, and she is so self-absorbed. I wanted to hit her. Didn't she realize that he was in danger? So he had a focus on it, but she wanted him to come home. So how did you create that? That's so real.
Yeah.
That's so real.
Yeah. Yeah, she was very narcissistic, and that is a problem that some people have. And so they're so self-absorbed, they don't realize much of anything else. Bradley Mitchell, let me go over the four storylines real quick, and then we can jump on to Mitchell.
Okay.
The first is the Sam Erickson storyline, which is the Marines. The beginning of the book, Sam Erickson's the first character you're going to see. And he is a reconnaissance platoon leader. He's a first lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
And he is, at that moment, leading his reconnaissance platoon, which typically does about 23 Marines, onto the beach in North Africa to try to create a second front and turn some of the Mahdi's forces away from Cairo. Put some pressure on the Mahdi's backside as such. And so he's a story. And then he's going to become involved kind of by happenstance with the reporter Lauren Wells. And yeah, she's an interesting character. She's rather because of her upbringing, she's rather she's rather tough, and so I didn't write her in a way. I thought some people aren't going to like her, and you just mentioned you weren't wild about her. I did that on purpose. But Erickson not only likes her, he loves her, and they have this kind of very fast rising romance. So that's story number one. Story number two then is the Americans have sent a Green Beret group, which is about 1,100 men, to Cairo to try to just do everything they can to keep the Egyptian army together and stop the Mahdi from entering Cairo. And so that story involves a young sergeant by the name of Charlie Sanders. Mm-hmm. And he's the primary character in that one. And I like Charlie. I actually did a tour with Green Berets, so I knew a bit about how they do things and how people like Charlie act. The third story that enters then is Bradley Mitchell, the one you just mentioned. He's a F-18 pilot off an aircraft carrier. And yes, his biggest problem is not his ability to fly a plane. He's very, very good at that. But the fact that he's got a wife back home who, as he admits in the book, he made the mistake of marrying his trophy wife, who's the daughter of a very rich and powerful businessman. And his wife, very narcissistic, very self-centered. She creates a lot of problems for him. I don't want to give too much away to the reader, but she's going to be a problem for Bradley Mitchell. And actually, it's funny you mentioned him because that's my daughter's favorite character. She loves Mitchell.
Me too.
Yeah. And I thought he was a very relatable character. He and his sidekick, I can't remember his real name, but his nickname was Worm, his sidekick. And then the fourth story involves an army platoon sergeant who finds himself at the same time that the Mahdi attacks Egypt, Iraq and Iran join together and attack Saudi Arabia. So he's in a desperate situation in Walton finds himself in a desperate situation in Saudi Arabia, trying to hold on until reinforcements can get there. So that's the four stories. So I don't want to give away too much. I want to leave a lot for the readers. But that's the four stories. So those four stories will go on. And so you may have five chapters in a row with Sam Erickson, and then you may not see him again for another 6 or 8 or 10 chapters, just depending on how the story's going. You might be on Charlie Sanders or Walton or Mitchell. But what I found with, you were asking about Mitchell's wife and her father's ability to cause him problems. That's very real world. I've seen that. I saw that in the military a number of times where, people would put pressure on, to cause things to happen that weren't the best actually for the individual involved or for our country. And it kind of arises. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I think it kind of arises from my observations of all the people who were able to dodge the draft, and they were typically rich people who had powerful people behind them. And so I'd seen how that worked, and so I kind of just tied that in there and used that that reality. And this Mitchell's wife's father has lots of connections with senators and people like that, and so he's able to use his influence to allow his daughter to kind of get her way. So again, I don't want to give any more away than that, but we'll leave that for the readers.
I know if you listen to the news, you know there are a lot of people like that that are out there. So let's get back to my other. I actually like the Mahdi. I like the character, even though he's evil. I began to understand his mindset, but I have to tell you, I read this book in a very unique way. Seriously, I read the whole book twice. Then I went and I read Erickson's parts, and then I read the Monty's part. I wrote each of the four stories separately so that when I wrote my review and I asked my questions, I would get it right.
Oh.
I have a master's in reading, and I had a professor that taught me something very, very interesting, and that was how to understand past what was on the page. So there's like an underlying deep structure in writing. So when somebody doesn't get what the book is about, I do. So we have another character that I like also for the limited time. That is the Mahdi's wife, Sharif, and his family. Mm-hmm. How did he meet this person? I really liked her, seriously.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
I got a lot of tissues in this book, a lot of boxes of tissues, people. That's all I'm going to say. So how does she help shape his life, and why does she put up with everything? He wasn't sure about her because she's very rich, and he wasn't.
Well, yeah,
no,
yeah.
Actually, how did you create her? I liked her.
I don't know. These characters just show up sometimes. I'm not sure, Fran. Honestly, you've written. You know, it's kind of. You're just kind of, and I'm not a big outliner. I kind of like to outline more as I go than, outline the next three or four chapters as I go. And the characters just somehow seem to appear sometimes. And she was one of those. And Murad's story, quite honestly, I think those are his backstory might be my favorite chapters I've ever written.
Yeah, me too.
And I've had so many readers, my wife was a school teacher for 45 years. She taught elementary school, and she goes up to the local school and works, even though she's retired, works with kids who have reading problems. And we were up there, she and I, judging a contest the kids had done, art projects and reading, writing projects and things. And one of the teachers, I guess, had gotten an advanced copy of the book from my wife, and she just said, I didn't know what to do with the Mahdi. I loved him, but I hated him. That was exactly what I had in mind. And I started him from his actual birth, but we moved pretty quickly. And he's a very meek and mild little individual. He probably weighs 100 pounds, and he's maybe 5 feet tall. And he's really not an aggressive individual at all, and yet they force him into this role. And so after his father dies, his uncle sends him then, because he's living in this village where like two people can read, So, but they see the talent in him, so he sends him to Algiers to a very rigid Muslim preparatory school, where he goes to high school and excels, comes back home, and the uncle isn't happy because he needs him to have learned about the world. And the last thing that Muhammad Murad wants anything to do with is the world. And so his father sends him on to school in France, which his father was killed by the French in the Algerian Revolution in the late 50s, early 60s. And so he hates the French, and yet he ends up going there. And while he's there, he meets Sharif. Sharif actually kind of comes to his rescue. She's a very rich, her father's one of the richest men in Egypt. And she comes to his rescue. He has never had any contact with women. His years in the preparatory school, his years in his village, he's very rigid. He doesn't have any desire to even get to know women, to talk to them, to understand them. And yet Sharif changes all that for him. She makes him into much more of a person. And strangely enough, she falls she's very pretty and she's very rich. She falls in love as much with him as he does with her. And she's willing, because he's forced to go back to his village. His uncle has died and he needs to take over essentially control of the village and run the village. And she throws everything away. She takes on a very rigid dress, traditional dress, and goes and throws everything away and goes to live with him in this little village in Algiers. And I don't want to tell the readers anymore because their life together is really, really pretty neat. And so I'll just leave it at that, and the reader will have to discover what happens with him and Sharif.
Yeah, I know. I was like, so, but it's what happens. I don't want to say what happens next is what sends him over the edge.
Exactly.
And that's what, I know. It's what happens next that sends him over the edge, which is when I really can understand that it made sense as to what he did. I mean, if you listen to the news, but it's not quite as understandable what they're doing. So the battle lines are drawn, and each side is powerful, both sides. I mean, you have our side and their side. And they had weapons. The Mahdi targeted Egypt, you said, in Cairo. And we responded in military power. And then you have this really got me. The Iranians and Iraqis who hate each other fighting on the same side. There were so many battles that are lost, and yet there is no time to mourn the dead. How do people deal with that in real life? I mean, there were so many things that happened, and then, of course, what happens to send him over the edge, you can't blame him at that point, seriously.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, what happens is, and you saw it with Erickson, actually, there sometimes is time to mourn. If you remember after the initial, when he and his unit goes ashore, let's say things don't go as perfectly as the Americans would like, and the next morning he has the task of identifying the dead from his platoon, and he's clearly mourning, and he's clearly lost, essentially. So there sometimes is time for that. Lots of times it's a delayed reaction. It'll happen years later. This PTSD thing, it will. It varies from individual to individual how we handle these kinds of things, how we handle anything in life. I mean, that's just the way we are. Something that might bother me greatly, you might handle easily, or vice versa. So it's just a reality. When you're trying to simply stay alive and keep breathing, there's not time to mourn those who no longer are alive. But there'll be time later. Don't worry. That's kind of how this stuff sometimes happens. But Erickson, you can see he's very, very human, because even on that first morning, he's very distressed by what's happened.
Well, I can imagine. What do I really like, though? This is my next question, my next brilliance here, is that you didn't have one side overkilling the other side. Both sides were fighting, but you didn't cause one side to win over the other side at times. Both sides had their victories. I mean, how did you decide which side is going to win and which side wasn't? And my other favorite part was the blackjack section and Johnnyman, Mitchell, and Gunny. So how did you create them? I really like those. They were my favorite people.
Well, how I decided who won each battle is kind of... I mean, when I write my books, as I said, I don't really outline them much, but I know the beginning and I know the end. Typically, I write the end of the book first. I mean, I end up having to go back and make some minor corrections to it when I actually get there. But I know the beginning scene. I know the ending scene. And so how do I get from where I'm at point A or point Z, wherever I'm at, point D, if I'm at point D at this point in the book, how do I move that toward where my ending wants it to go? And so that will kind of dictate who's going to win which battle is where we are in the book. Early on, I figured the Marines would struggle greatly, and they did. The Americans struggle greatly early on, and they get stronger as the book goes on, which would make sense because... As you go on, you can bring in more aircraft carriers and more forces, and so that's it. Just kind of, I don't know. You know, it's like asking me how do I write, and I honestly can't tell you. I just do. It just I don't write like anybody else. I don't, like I said, I don't do great outlines. I almost, mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes I'll write the middle of a chapter first or the end even of a chapter first, and or a couple of sentences here and a couple of sentences there, and then just string mm-hmm. it all together. I will tell you, my editor at Penguin Random House, when I described how I write my books, looked at me like I had six heads. So, but the bottom line is you get all the word. I mean, I consider it like 150,000 word or 150,000 piece jigsaw puzzle, and you just put all the pieces together, and when you're done, you've got a picture. So, you know, how did they figure out who was going to win each battle? I don't know. You know, how did they figure out that Charlie Sanders was going to get himself in pretty deep trouble? Not sure, but
did.
It just, you know, they just come, they just show up. You kind of work with each character, and sometimes the character leads you to where the character wants you to go, and sometimes you lead the character. It just kind of varies. And so let's see, who were the other ones you mentioned? You mentioned Gunny, who is, Erickson's, mm-hmm. Platoon sergeant. And, yeah, he very much, struck me as, the epitome of a really excellent Marine platoon sergeant. You know, he that it was his life. This is what he wanted to do, and this is what he did, and he did it well. So his character was not hard to develop at all, because there are certain expectations that whether it's Marines or Army or Navy or Air Force that you have for those who lead platoons or units. Who were a couple of the others you wanted to talk about?
Well, I'm going to bring in somebody else because we have about 15 minutes.
Okay.
We got to bring her in. This was really mind-boggling. Sam gets hurt, and Lauren decides that she was going to question him no matter what. That's what started there off. And then
right,
she
right.
goes, and this was absolutely so unbelievable, that she interviewed the Mahdi, and it created this mutual respect. And that, I had a funny feeling I would figure out the ending, which I did, sort of. And I think I would have been disappointed if you didn't end it that way. Seriously?
Oh, okay. The very ending, you mean? Yes.
Yeah,
the last
I don't
thing.
Think anybody
yeah.
else felt like that. But I think that it made sense to me. And yet, what can I say? People don't always think. So how did you get her? How did you create this step part where she interviews him? And then she interviews, and then she becomes very with close to Sam, but they're so controlled about their jobs that it didn't become a typical relationship, because her job is more important than, and his job is more important than getting together permanently. So why did you allow her to speak with the Mahdi? That was really good.
Well, a couple of reasons. The Mahdi is, he doesn't like cities at all. His
yeah.
time in Algiers, his time in Marseille, he did not enjoy those times, other than meeting his wife in Marseille.
Mm-hmm.
But he's very uncomfortable around cities. He's growing up in the desert in a village where almost no one's ever been more than 10 miles from the village. And so it's a very insular life he was living. And to suddenly thrust him into the world was extremely difficult for him, and he never took to it well.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's actually running his federation after he conquers these other countries from a very isolated spot up in the mountains in along the Algerian-Libyan border. And what really happens, and I don't say it out loud, but what really happens is his followers believe he can mm-hmm. use some cover here, because the pressure from the Americans in the world is becoming
yeah.
pretty big. So he's never done an interview on Arab television. He's never done an interview with anybody. And yet they decide, let's do one with this American reporter. Lauren Wells has been a Middle East reporter for, I think I say 5 years in the book. I can't remember now,
mm-hmm.
3 to 5 years,
yeah.
something like that. And she's very well known. She's very popular in, you know, with the American public and in the news business. She's very, very good at what she does. not very old, only about 30. And they identify her, and she speaks fluent Arabic, just on top of that. They identify her as, the Mahdi's lieutenants identify her as the ideal person to interview him. And I really don't go into that in the book, but what they're really trying to do is provide cover because they are planning to attack Egypt within a few months. And yet, in the interview, he says he has no intention of doing that. So it's they're kind of trying to disarm the world and make him less threatening. And so that's why they did the interview. I didn't really bring that up in the book, but that was their actual purpose. And so they picked her. She's taken up into the desert, into his headquarters, and she interviews the Mahdi's and gets to know him. And he actually kind of likes her, not in any kind of physical sense. She's very attractive, but more he just likes her as an intelligent. He doesn't realize it till very late in the book, but she reminds him of Sharif, his wife, and as far as intelligence and just how she conducts herself. And so what happens then is, she's very aggressive doing her job, which is why she's become, I mean, she's on her way up in the news business. And in fact, in my third book, she's now on the anchor desk for one of the major networks. So the book I'm presently writing. And so she's very aggressive. And naturally, there's a pool of reporters in this huge naval armada that shows up with the Marines. And she gets herself ashore. She's the only reporter who finagles herself ashore. Mm-hmm. And Erickson's there. He's exhausted. He's mourning his men. And she tries to interview him. He refuses. She won't let him refuse, so she does the interview. And for whatever reason, she kind of sees a spark in him that fascinates her. And so later on, I'm not going to say how, but they end up back together. And so at first they're not sure if it's just a little wartime romance. They finally realize by the end of the book that it's much, much more than that. This is the one person for them, and I'll let the reader see what happens from there. Because I think we wrap it up at the end, don't we, with them?
Well, I'm not going to say what it is. We're going to only bring in one more.
Let's put it this way. They're back together in book three. So.
The end. I'm so glad. No, seriously. I knew there's going to be a sequel because it just didn't seem that it was time to end it. Seriously. And the reason why there's a sequel, I'm not going to say. But for those of you that read it, you're going to go, oh, my God, did that really happen? Or did they really do that? Or did they really didn't do it? Oh, my God. I think that anyone in their right mind probably would have said, why did you end the book that way? And then when you think about Lauren and the other person, you say, well, okay, maybe that makes sense. And then the ending was like, oh, I said, oh, my God. But I had a funny feeling you were going to do that, seriously. So without saying that it was. That was a good ending, by the way. You had the President of the United States and his advisors. What role did he play in this? Yet on both sides, you begin to wonder if anybody was going to win. And basically, you'll find that out in the next book, right?
Actually, not exactly. I'm going to use some of the same characters, but I'm actually going to I'm going to move Sam and Lauren and a couple of Sanders. To Pakistan in the next book into a different scenario. So the sequel to The Chosen One is still out there. I may or may not write it, but I at least have a follow-up book for those characters.
You got to write it. I got to see where
the president
you got to write it
so
I can see what happens. Yeah, you got to see what happens to the person at the end. I would be disappointed. Because I told everybody there's going to be a sequel, and everybody listens to whatever I say. Everybody, as a matter of fact, after I posted your review, like everybody read it in 5 seconds, I'd go like, what? I just pushed send. I mean, really? They do. It's scary. So You just said that you're going to bring Sam back and Lauren and a few others. Mm-hmm. What is in Pakistan? What exactly can you give away? We have about 8 minutes left on my clock over here.
Well, the third book, The Americans Are Going to Find Themselves in Deep Trouble Again.
Good.
What's going to, yeah, we can't have the Americans just getting off easy here. So,
no.
What's going to happen is, and again, I looked at it historically. Pakistan's going to make a mistake, and they're going to end up starting a war with India.
Nice.
For those of you who know the history all the way back from the late 40s till now, those two countries, while they were one country at one point, despise each other. And what's going to happen is India is going to win the war, but not take over the country completely. They're going to stop at a certain point and say, okay, we're too terrified of your 200 nuclear missiles, which Pakistan has close to that now, for us to actually be foolish enough to trigger a nuclear war. So we've beaten your army, but we're stopping right here. And what that does is it causes the Pakistani government and military to collapse. And while the people of Pakistan have never been all that thrilled with their government, they're very, very prideful of their military. They really, really think highly of them. So when the military collapses, that leaves a huge void that some terrorists are going to, a terrorist group's going to come in and take over the country, essentially, seize the nuclear weapons, surround the American embassy where Lauren Wells is going to find herself, and Sam Erickson's going to show up and try to rescue them all. So that's kind of that book. Plus, Charlie Sanders, my Green Beret, is going to go after the nuclear weapons. So we'll leave it at that for now.
Okay, before I forget, I'm going to put my glasses back on now that I found them. Monday, New York Times author Vincent Zandri and New York Times author Lee Matthew Goldberg will be talking about thriller writers and who else, whatever else they come up with, which is just fine. On February 3rd, this is like a big honor. A very well-known hand surgeon and plastic surgeon, Dr. Jeffrey Jacobson, is going to take spotlight. We're going to talk about carpal tunnel syndrome, arthritis syndrome, and any other hand issues that people should know about. And he just operated on my hand last month. I had trigger finger, and it's no longer triggered, people. It's hurts, but it's fine. On the 4th, someone I adore, Brian Friedman, Thief River Falls, a psychological drama, and you wonder if the character is delusional or not. On the 19th, the author of The Neighborhood. You don't want to move into this one, that's for sure. On the 24th, someone we all know and love, R.G. Belsky, or as he's a.k.a. Dana Perry, The Silent Victim, scary book. And on the 27th, the poor three authors who's I had to cancel three times for whatever reason, Murder of Montague, and the Murders of Montague Murders, and there's three authors that are coming on that. And that's just February. You ain't seen nothing in March. So tell us, where can we learn more about you and your work, and when is the next book coming out, seriously?
Well, I'm not sure when the next one comes out. It is sold to Penguin Random House, and I think I have to have it to them by the 1st of December, so probably won't be until sometime in mid to late 2021 would be my guess. First of all, Fran, thank you for having me on, and thank you for loving The Chosen One so much. I mean, nothing pleases an author more.
I was so disappointed. I'm going like, he has to call in because I've been waiting for this one. I've read so many books, and sometimes when I interview somebody, I never write negative reviews, ever, seriously, because I've had a couple on my own that people wrote, I don't understand your book. I said, well, then maybe you need to take a lesson in comprehension. I'm so sorry. My books are written from the point of view of the dead body behind the gravestone. Either they did something wrong and they belong there, and they're telling their story, or somebody put them there because they did them wrong. And it's different, very different.
Well, anyway, let me again, thank you for that. I'm astounded that you read it more than twice. and so very pleased. So I hope your readers will like it at least half as much as you did. It's available in bookstores. It might be best to call because it's not obviously not in every local bookstore, but it's available. They certainly can get you a copy. Amazon, of course, and usual outlets. We have it in print, ebook, or audiobook, and I'm told the audiobook's really well done. The same guy who narrated The Red Line did the audiobook for this one. And his claim to fame is he was one of the caddies in Caddyshack. So, and a real nice guy, and I was really pleased when he did this one. So if they'd rather listen to it, they can listen to it. If they want to read it and hold it in their hands, they can do that. Or if they want to read it on their computer, they can do that. But I appreciate you having me on. If we got a minute or two and you still have another question, I'll try to answer it. I've enjoyed this immensely. I hope we can do it again with the next book. And I encourage your friend actually to read.
I was hoping you to say that.
Yeah, I tell you what.
I really, this is so real life. Seriously. So without giving it away, I have time for one more question. Why did you create that particular ending? And I understand why the Americans, what happens with Laura next and the Mahdi. I understand that. But how did you create that particular ending to let me know that you have to write the next one? Seriously. I'd be very disappointed if you don't. I can't wait to see what you do with it.
I can't wait either. So, I don't know. Again, the stuff, it just comes to you. I can't explain it. I'm not really a writer. I've never considered myself. This isn't something I necessarily intended to ever do. The story for The Red Line just came to me, and I wrote that, and took me many years, but I got it published, and in the interim, I wrote The Chosen One. How they come to you, I don't know. I mean, you just, I guess maybe every writer should maybe be put away somewhere because we just have these wild imaginations that, that just seemed like the right ending to me. I don't know.
It was.
What I really liked about this one that I didn't get to do in The Red Line is I was able to bring most of the characters, all but one storyline was together at the end of the book. They all came together. And in The Red Line, which, by the way, Fran, you ought to read The Red Line if you like this one. I'm told it might be about half my readers like The Red Line better and about half like The Chosen One better. It just worked. You go in there, and sometimes, quite honestly, you write into a dead end and you throw it away and you start over with that part. And with my ending, it took a while to make it all work together and get all the flaws out of it and make sure. I will tell you, readers, that the ending takes place at the Great Pyramid. And just to make sure that I had every little detail about the Great Pyramid right, took a while, So I don't know. I mean, how do I write? I don't know. I sit here at this screen and think I'm never going to write another word, and the words just start coming out. So I don't know. It is what it is. I don't consider myself to be especially unique or, I'm just kind of a struggling writer who's got now two books out there and a third on the way, and we'll keep trying. Hopefully we'll keep getting readers like you who love it. So,
well, I'm glad you came on my show. You're really lucky that Random House took it. They don't take everything, so they must think that this is first rate. I'm going to email your publicist and tell her. I'm going to send her the link, and I told her, ignore the first 5 minutes. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, I really apologize for that. Honestly, they had given me one of the numbers they gave me was wrong. It was
I saw it when I had the question page, and I know that when I emailed her, I did give her the right number. So I just emailed her, and I said, oh, hopefully she'll get my email. Then I emailed you 7 times because I finally got your email. So that's just me. But I want to thank you so much. It's freezing. I don't know where you are, but it's freezing here. It's like, It's freezing.
Yeah, we're in
like
Austin,
20...
Texas, which, oh, yeah, there's all your emails. I see them now. They were actually on my author emails rather than my working emails, so I typically only go to those a couple times a day. I apologize for not being on time. I on time. But I'm in Austin, Texas, which normally the winters aren't bad, but we're having a 100% rain day and I think a high in low 50s maybe. So it's not real pleasant today, but most days are nice. So.
Yeah, it's 20 degrees here. We're having a cold day. But I want to thank you so much. Everyone, stay warm. I hope I get the next book. Whenever you're ready for another interview, let me know. Everybody have a great day, and bye.